I'm concerned that we explore and rediscover the special world and spirituality of the John Gospel, and perhaps if we get into that world, there are ways in which it will nurture the differences among us, which enrich us and help us in having both some kind of unity and diversity, a unity which lives on the multiplicity of gifts rather than on controlling the gifts of that are diverse. I want to begin by plugging a particular book that's in the bookstore, a book by Gerd Tyson called Shadow of the Galilean. This book helps you recover a sense of the different people in Jesus' society. It's in the, not a very good novel, but it's in the form of a novel. It's imaginative, so Jesus doesn't appear in the book. What you see in the book are the shadow that Jesus casts and on the different groups. Very often we take Jesus out of the turmoil of his times, and then we have a Jesus which doesn't get involved in the turmoil of our times. And I'm working on the strategy, using the strategy that if we see how Jesus fit into turmoil, maybe he can be more at home in our lives and in our world. I begin with a prayer that moves us into the gospel. Blow, wind, blow, and fan the sparks of passion. Breathe, breath, breathe, and restore our lives. I arranged the text in terms of context, the study in terms of context, text, and directions. And I begin with context. The John context, the larger narrative context. I tend to focus on a story as a story, a narrative as a narrative, and it is my conviction that there are many ways in which we have used the Bible for control rather than for nurture. There's a profound struggle over kinds of power in the world and in the church, and that we desperately, we need to learn to read for energy and power, not simply for pattern and control. And that they're in the text. Notice that I believe the Bible is a gift and a providence and a way in which God speaks to us, but I think we have responsibility as persons and as communities for how we read the Bible and how the world uses the Bible. And so I strongly am convinced that we need to do community Bible study in a way that nurtures our sense of responsibility and direction and frees us from superficial kinds of power and control. The John difference. The John difference, I'll keep coming back to this, but I'd like to just rehearse for you some of the differences. There are what we can call rearrangements of the synoptic, the Mark, Matthew, Luke material. Rearrangements. One is that if you notice the Sermon on the Mount and the other Q materials, Jesus' sayings tend to be short. They tend to be little stories like parables, which may be as they may be a metaphor, a light that is set should be set on a candlestick, or they may be more elaborate stories like the prodigal son. But they're aphoristic, they're wisdom type sayings. In John, Jesus talks gives long speeches. There's a person that starts a dialogue, that person asks a dumb question or does a dumb thing, and then Jesus has an excuse for a monologue, and in which there is a kind of creation of new language. In a way, maybe what the church is about, or what Bible study is about, is creating the vernacular or the translation, which empowers us to act as community and helps us as persons. Rearrangements, sayings become speeches. And characters become occasions, and are not fully developed. There's one particular rearrangement that I'd like you to notice, and that's the cleansing of the temple. This is a conflict scene. It occurs in Mark, Matthew, Luke, right before the crucifixion of Jesus, and that's where it makes historical sense. It's the kind of disturbing of the peace, like burning a draft card, that kind of explodes a crowd situation and precipitates Jesus' arrest. So it makes very good sense right at the beginning of Passion Week. In John, it's in chapter 2. The disciples get called. You have the blessing of the wine at Cana. You have sort of an affirmation of celebration. And bingo, you have the cleansing of the temple. And conflict. I see that rearrangement as John's signal that there's a shape to John's testimony. It isn't just this comes here and this comes here. John is not so worried about what exactly, he's not doing a docudrama. He's doing a faith drama, okay? He's trying to lay out and draw people into a way of experiencing Jesus Christ. And in next to the beginning, there is conflict. Oh, it's okay to walk around. There are other microphones here. So I'm going to put you to the test, brother. We are so afraid of conflict and anger and turmoil. We are so afraid of conflict. And we have read the Bible so that conflict and anger and tension are bad, and calmness and serenity and being nice to one another is good. Now there's a problem. It papers over all the grief and problems. Anybody who's been a teacher knows that some of the best, anybody who's been a therapist knows that nobody changes until they're uncomfortable. Anybody that's been a teacher knows that nobody learns anything until you see the issue, the conflicts. And here we are trying to make the whole Bible and our use of the Bible be so harmless. You know, excuse me, my life is a turmoil and church is boring. And so what they do, there's a sign at the door that says, leave all your baggage, leave all the problems outside. And you come into the church, and it's, well, anyhow, there are some reasons. I think the notion of centering and the notion of having a moment of serenity to sort out your baggage is a very good one, but you kind of get the spillover of this idea. Anyhow, I think John Bultmann commentary has all of these Jesus scenes marked crisis, the German word krisis. There is an issue, there is a confrontation in the present, and that confrontation reflects that a next rearrangement. So much for the cleansing of the temple. The second, there's the Logos hymn that we talked about yesterday. That's brand new in the Gospels. There's another thing that happens. You know how in Mark you get to chapter 13 and you have this Star Wars kind of vision of turmoil, conflict, everything's going to go down the tubes, and then the Son of Man is going to come space in on a cloud with power and great glory. It is the scene and image which created our expectations of judgment and the second coming of Jesus and the way in which God holds the world accountable. It's gone. It's gone. It's not in John. The only thing that's left is half a dozen little shreds of reference to judgment in the future. What's in its place? There is a farewell, this so-called farewell discourse, which is basically the homily that Jesus gives at his last Seder with his disciples. So you have a very intimate scene in which Jesus nurtures from the inside, his small group of followers. There's another difference about that Seder scene. There's no bread and wine mentioned, but there's foot washing. And there's another important difference in John. There's no Pentecost, there's a breathing of the Spirit, so that the Spirit comes directly from Jesus to the disciples before Jesus leaves. So the John world is a different Jesus drama. It's a different story, rich in its energy and power and problems. The text, John 12, 1 through 8. The context. I selected this particular text because, not because of their context. I selected John 1 because I think we have lost the context of Genesis and wisdom, and so have compressed word into thing and not allowed it to be happening and voice in the middle of mystery. I selected this text because of something in our context. In other words, I am suggesting that the points at which there is a difference, the points we need to talk about in the Bible are the points where the context of origin is different from the context of reception. And sometimes it's best approached by how we're different, and sometimes it's best approached by how they're different. But where one of the contexts is different, there needs to be some kind of reflection on, correction for the differences in language and setting. One of the differences that is big and is introduced in this text is the presence of women. We are a society where conscience and responsibility has led us to work arduously, sometimes successfully, sometimes depressingly, sometimes misguidedly, work arduously for a new understanding of power and authority, so that instead of power over, we have power with. Instead of control, we look for direction. Instead of orders, we look for collaboration. There is a earthquake in change in Western tradition that circles around here, and one of the figures in the middle is the figure of women. We'll deal with another one tomorrow when we talk about the Holocaust and the way in which people have used the Bible to nurture anti-Semitism. Okay, women. In this text, there is a happening where Jesus honors a woman's passion and a woman's gift. Now, the Gospel of John is a curious place. The community of John is a curious place. There are no women disciples. There are no women disciples. Lord knows it took us a long time to have women pastors. And even if we have women pastors, we still don't have many senior pastors that are women. So there are no women disciples, but women get a lot of space here. The largest dialogue with the woman is the woman of Samaria. And women occasion teaching and learning from Jesus. There's a long chapter in which Mary and Martha are the ones that are nudging Jesus to do something. There's this chapter which kind of goes with the Mary-Martha chapter in 11. You really have a Mary-Martha section that goes from 11 to 12, and it includes the resurrection and then this piece. And the other thing it was kind of amazing when I heard a woman who teaches at the Jesuit seminary talk about it and brought it to my attention. The first and major witness to the risen presence of Christ is Mary Magdalene. And it's a large, important resurrection appearance, and it's to a woman. So there's something going on here that is beginning to break new ground in a conventional, patriarchal, traditional society. There's something going on here that, without totally revising the structure, has happened in the John community that is reflected by these stories. So, pay attention to the presence of women, of Mary. Number two, We come out of a culture where selves have different kinds of, there are different kinds of walls between different parts of the self. Most of therapy, a lot of therapy has to do with people learning to converse inside of themselves about their different voices. We come out of a society which builds, because of its fear over threat, of the threats to human dignity, really builds all kinds of fences. And many of the fences get to be so high that they imprison people instead of simply be boundaries that signal people and guide people. You don't, after all, need a chain link fence to keep people from going over a cliff. You may need a guardrail. You may need a sign that says, somebody got killed here. But you don't build a chain link fence on a mountain highway. You try to make sure that people have a driver's license and know the difference between the throttle and the brake. Okay? Now see, notice what I'm doing. I'm saying, hey, Eros is a good thing in life, but do you need to put up a chain fence to keep people? Don't you, in the same process, make life apathetic and passive? Where is the passion? I mean, I'm not saying Eros and passion are the same thing, but we got a sort of passionless, we got a passionless Christianity. All you have to do is read some of the mystics to know that it was perfectly okay to love God. It's perfectly okay to love God. Now we're so worried that people think right about God. There's no, we don't love God anymore. Or even try, I mean, maybe we don't love God. We don't love God perfect. We'll never love God perfectly, but a little bit would help. A little bit of passion. So here you got a woman who's being very passionate. And excuse me, if somebody's ever massaged your feet, this is feely-touchy, excuse me, and it's in the Bible. So what do you do with that? Feely-touchy, and this woman takes her hair and wipes his feet, for goodness sakes. If this is at least an R, maybe an X-rated story, you don't put this in the Bible. It's not fit for children. Okay. So there it is. So, Pet, you know, what do you do with that? Of course, one of the worst dangers in our society is sexual, one person's use of another person's body. Whether it's slaving for slavery or whether it's for sex, whatever. You know, there's nothing more shocking than incest or rape. And even with our very confused sense of morality, we all know that, and especially on children. But it's all there, it's under the carpet, you know, and it's just causing, I mean, bishops spend their life settling suits because it's been swept under the carpet for so long, and anyhow, you know the story. But so I'm not saying that we don't need boundaries. But because we need boundaries, does that mean we have to become unfeeling people? Maybe we just ought to learn where the road is, and when we get off, you know. Maybe, I don't know. So anyhow, bodies, eros, passion. I got another problem for you. There's a verse in this text, and this illustrates, and tomorrow I'm going to show you some more verses like this, that illustrate a problem that we as a Christian community have to deal with. There's a verse here that gives permission for rich Christians to ignore poverty. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. Okay? Well, it's perfectly all right to spend $500,000 on the organ if you give $30,000 to Bread for the World. Were you the one? Somebody last night in Marty's session was talking about how, somebody talked about how it always gets in the paper when a rich person gives 1/200th, one 200th of their income to a good cause, which isn't really much more than the widow's mite, and they get a tax deduction besides, and that's what gets in the paper. And and this verse blesses them. This verse blesses them. What do you do with this? I mean, you read the lessons in church, and this is what people, everybody brings stuff into the church, brings scripts into the church, and they don't listen to the whole story. You don't read big portions of the Bible. They hear one verse that gives them an excuse for what they're doing, and you grab it. So what do you do with this? What do you do with this? Is there any sense in which, the point I want to make is, who is responsible for helping correct misreadings of the text? The people who know what it means or the people who don't know what it means? People who know what it means, people who don't know. Anyway. So those are my griefs in the text. Those are my the things that I will focus on, or things that I want you to notice before you start. And then we're going to take a minute, and I'm going to ask you to read the text. And then I'd like a volunteer to read it slowly and out loud. Who would be willing to read the text? Thank you, Eric. Okay, I'll let you know when but we have time to be quiet with the text. I'm pretty noisy when I get going, so you need time to get back to the text.
We do always have a problem with this.
But if it's a fact, then why bother, Bob?
Why bother what?
With the poor. And it isn't a fact, actually. There isn't any poor in Scandinavia. There's plenty of poor in New York City, but there aren't poor. Anything like the poverty in Scandinavia and Sweden and Finland that there is in the United States. And there's nothing like the poverty in the United States that's like poverty in the third world. So it isn't true. Well, it isn't really a fact. I challenge it as a universal, and
I think it's true in the world. I think they get away with not having it.
I think we're coming from a different place. But I worry about that reading, number one, because it may be a dangerous way to look at the world, and number two, because I wonder if even that saying it's a fact doesn't give secular folk even more permission to be selfish than saying that Jesus said it. I just wonder about that.
This is a story with very very mixed motives, especially the commentator Judas here.
She.
What?
That's weird.
Go ahead, it's going to take about a minute or
so.
Okay. Anyway, Judas, we find out, is a thief, And his motives are assessed in the text. He says what he says about giving to the poor because he really wants to keep it in the treasury, at least that's implied, so he can take some of it. So there's this kind of twist. Who is the poor? There's also a question, there's also a conflict here in time. It's said that this substance that is put on Jesus' feet is for his burial. But he has it applied now, he isn't dead. It makes me think of Ecclesiastes, that there is a right time for everything. There is a right time, and that the fact is that God's time for things are not our time. That we very frequently don't get the timing right. And for Jesus, this is the right time for this activity. And that it has very little to do with the poor. And in fact, the allegation of it being poor, everybody in the Jewish community, I think, really needs to have proper burial. That's granted even maybe to the poor, somebody gets a proper burial. So I think there's a lot of different things in here.
One of the things that bothers me about the text too is, what's the role of extravagance in our lives? He kind of forgave the extravagance of the perfume because it was going to be used for his burial.
Excuse me, I don't know quite how these systems work. So, can you signal me or when he has something to say? Because I don't.
Yeah, it takes a little while to program it in, and it says the words as he does it.
Will he just interrupt us and not wait till the time is passed?
We'll break it.
Okay, you do. So you jump in when you're ready.
But the discomfort in this whole passage for me is, what's the role of extravagance in our lives? Is extravagance ever excusable in Jesus' mind? Here he kind of forgives the extravagance of the perfume because she was going to use it for a burial, but if she wasn't going to use it for his burial, is it still okay to have cabins and sailboats and cars at work and stuff like that?
I'm looking for a piece of paper to write down the word extravagance. I love that word, Robert.
she used a whole pound of this stuff. It sounds to me like she could have gotten by with quite a bit less. I don't know what pound of this stuff in the whole house. It's a pretty extravagant occasion, and the perfume filled the place.
And of course, we are a totally wasteful, not only extravagant, but we're wasteful culture. So now notice, if you read this in the third world, it might not mean the same thing as it means to us when one of our major sins is extravagant. So again, context. But I want to make one point. In the text, there is a dismissing of Judas's remark, because Judas is jealous and is a thief. But the fact of the matter is, some thieves tell the truth. In other words, sometimes people who have bad motives say things that are true. So the fact that a person is corrupt doesn't mean that they haven't spoken the truth. I mean, you've got to, some politicians say things that are true even when they're kind of twisting the system. And so you can't get rid of the sentence by saying that they're corrupt because they may have said the truth. Okay? I think you're right on that in some sense in our culture, Judas's remark is absolute. I mean, I think, let's face it, this is what John is saying about the ball field. He's saying, why in the world should we have Marty is against the you know, building a new ballpark for the Twins when there are so many things that need doing, like education and stuff. And that's exactly this point. That's exactly this point. Shouldn't this money have been used for something really important rather than something totally luxurious? So,
what is too much for us?
What is too
she
much?
She is asking for thanks for the receipt from his dying.
Probably expressing her thanks, is what you're saying.
Okay. Now that's really interesting. That's, notice what he said. Sister Rosina was saying, she was putting the kind of framework around it that sentence comes out of. And what she said last hour was, of course this is a story, and a story has one main point, and for goodness sake, don't go off on a detour on the details. You know, we're so used to shredded Bible, Coleslaw Bible, where we pull the verse out that we need to justify what we're doing, that we don't always ask, what's the point of the story?
Yeah.
Or what's the point of this? And of course, this isn't the point of the story. The point of the story is her passion. And the point of Jesus' retort is exactly the same thing. You remember in the other story where Martha was dumping on Mary? Jesus says, well, leave her alone. She did a good thing. So here is this passionate, erotic, reckless woman who did something totally ridiculous, wasteful, and Jesus says, leave her alone. Leave her alone. It's all right. So notice what happens. What we have done in our reading is feel the need to make every detail true, and they don't need to be true. They're just part of the details. In other words, notice the principle here. One way of reading the Bible is to say everything is true until we prove it is not true. Supposing you do, everything is universal. Supposing we read the Bible as a storybook rather than as a set of laws and say, what's the story and how does that story apply to us? What's the precedent that we can use? All of a sudden, a lot of the cultural details which make that story clear won't get laid on a culture which is very different. Okay? Notice how we take cultural details from one world and lay them on our culture, or one story and one woman. Anyhow, that's the theoretical. Great comment. would you use the money to feed the poor, or would you use the money to make the church handicap accessible? They did a huge remodeling job at Central Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. Only they didn't make the chancel handicap accessible. And then they had a benefit concert for Lutheran Social Service.
Yeah.
And who is the, it's Zubin Mehta, that's the, that is the Israeli violinist who has a disability. And he couldn't, they had to carry him up, carry his wheelchair up to the chancel. Well, this poor thing is big, and maybe churches have to have this argument. I think that something about extravagant expression is important for humans to physically express love. But I think if it gives people, I think that for American society, the crisis of homelessness and poverty is just overpowering.
It's almost, it makes me think, because we just did a remodeling project at our church, and I think that there's something about that tension, you know, the struggle with it. The reality is that you need to kind of maintain, keep up, and make beautiful spaces you live in, because that's part of people's souls. You know, you are formed by what you're surrounded by, you know, but I think the tension, if you pay attention to all that you're called to be, it does sort of winnow out some of the, I don't know, it's almost like we have to live in that tension, because you need both in some ways. But somehow to go to either extreme, I don't know, I'm trying to express maybe what I personally went through from saying, well, I'm not going to give anything to this capital campaign, to giving to it. It came in that tension of trying to figure out for myself what the place of those different things are. And it is, and maybe it comes, and the tension is right here in this, again, you've talked about the conflict, you know, the tension is right here in this passage. And it is almost a personal struggle, or a church struggle in every case. And if you don't struggle with it at all, then maybe that's the problem. So I don't know. I don't think there's any easy answer. It almost comes more in the struggle.
I believe food should come first. To feed everybody should help others. I believe food should come first. You need a healthy body to help others.
Food should come first. You need a healthy body to help others.
Yeah.
You do feed your children breakfast before you take them to church. A mother feeds her. I have a wonderful illustration from Islamic society. I had two Muslims in my class on Islam, and one was talking, had been on Hajj, and was talking about going on Hajj. He was from an American family in Saudi, who was living in Saudi Arabia, and so they were a very prosperous family. And there was another man from Bangladesh, and he said, but you know, nobody should go on Hajj until no one in the country is hungry. So that in some sense, hunger takes precedence over I think in our society we have people who have vocations to different expressions. You have a very unusual church, though. This is a church in which there is a rich resources, and even the remodeling was designed to facilitate community, wasn't just to make it more beautiful. And but
there are, I mean, I was just thinking of things like, there was one person who paid for a wood ceiling in the community area because it was going to be dropped because it was considered extravagant. So then you think to yourself, and I mean, it's a lovely addition to it, and I think it's really nice that it's there. And each one of those decisions is so, it's within the conflict, and we decided to tithe, you know, for our sister congregations in Russia and Africa, but that was only 10% of what we spent on our own building, you know. So it really...
The opposite of that is a congregation in Minneapolis, which just decided to disband because there were too many Lutheran buildings. And they took the assets from the sale of the church and distributed it to a number of different causes. And we just, in our church in in Northfield, we had a growth upon grace campaign in which over half of the money was given away to other places. And it was just, there was one Sunday where the people were there to get checks and things like that, and it was just quite unusual. But anyhow, we are just about done, but
what
isn't any...
What is vowed?
I didn't hear.
What is Hajj?
Hajj is one of the forms of Muslim worship, is to go on pilgrimage to Mecca and reenact some of the founding scenes from the Quran. And it's sort of a Bible camp for Muslims. They are a retreat. Muslims go on Hajj to get renewed and re-energized for the faith. Do any of you have any response to Eros? Did you have something to say way back there?
It was further back.
Oh. Well, say it anyhow, Eric. We lost you.
I'm just struck going back to the... I was reading through the first several chapters of John this morning and thinking, this sounds like it was written to another community, separate from the other Gospels. It sounds like it's written to a community that is not part of the story, part of the Hebraic story. And so I started wondering, how is this message coming through? Then later on I found, well, the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeks such as these to worship Him. That's 4:23. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. It's, you know, the experience is gone. It's a matter of connecting logically, rationally with God as a primarily a philosophical entity in a way. This strikes me. I'm intrigued with James Cone's notion of. He's pioneered what is typically called black theology. He emphasizes the experience of oppression as a prerequisite for reception of the message of the gospel. And I wonder, how do we need to enter into that experience? You know, how do we need to enter into that experience of poverty in order to be receptive to the meaning of this? You know, without letting the message of riches be become self-justification for themselves.
Go on and fast.
Good point. Thank you.
Any other comments on passion or eros? My basic framing gesture is that there are many ways in which our world, the specializations of our world and the diversity of our world reinforce, and the traditions were at the delta of a history of a very complex intellectual history, and it tends to divide selves. Selves get fragmented, so passion gets walled off from intellect, and intellect gets distilled and abstract. Human beings are not machines. Human beings are not mathematics. Human beings are not facts. And we are the mathematical precision of thinking about facts tends to put a split between the right brain and the left brain. And so we need exercises that help us grow back together. So I was very intrigued by what Linda Breitag did yesterday afternoon in Interplay. We need conversations that enable our passion and our rationality to blend. We need ways of thinking that make a consensus between the different parts of ourself. And in our society, we don't really have time. We have to make all kinds of decisions without the time to make them whole. And so it's a very difficult culture. I mean, it's a marvelous culture. I mean, I think of medicine. We would all have shorter lives if it were not for medicine. And yet there's so many ways in which the efficiency of medicine work against your own autonomy for your and intentionality for staying well. Some people seem almost robbed of their responsibility for health, and medicine doesn't mean to do this, and yet you let the doctor be responsible. So there are dilemmas. There are all these ambiguities, and somehow there's this dilemma between rationality and passion and eros. And friendship is a good example. I don't think you can be friends without eros. But you don't have to go to bed with everybody that you're friends with. You don't have to make lifelong commitments to every friend. There are friends which are friends for a time. You walk along a path together and you have really passionate bonding, but you're not using each other bodily, and you're not making
commitments. It goes back to sharing with one another.
The acts of sharing with one another are an expression of passion and eros. And connect people. And I'm appalled at a society where you go to bed before you make friends. It's not smart.
Trusting.
Okay.
Trusting.
What?
Trusting.
No.
Yeah, humanness depends on trust, and this is a society where you can't trust everybody.